Working? Excellent. All right, my name's Oliver Hookins. I work for a company called Anchor Systems, doing systems administrative stuff. Sort of brief overview of who I am. So background to this, and I should say yes, this is quite pressed for time. Probably won't be too much time for questions, but the Mind Skill one will be 60 minutes, so I'll be able to go into a bunch of details of that one. So who am I and how do I get here? About a year and a half ago, we had a client coming to us with a web application sort of proposal. They wanted us to design a trusted MySQL solution for that. At that point, I had absolutely no idea about MySQL replication, other than I was aware vaguely that it existed. So I stayed up all night reading the thrilling MySQL documentation and came in the next day to the meeting with guns firing, and we got the job, and it was all cool. So we went about designing the system, and that's been in production for about a year now, and it's been you know, tears and laughter and all the entire range of emotions, but I'm going to try and share that with you now. So I'm going to assume that you're all familiar with single database systems. Every man and his dog has got a LAMP server out there somewhere, so if you don't have any idea about my single database, then what are you doing? We're not going to be dealing with the application side. I'm not a developer. I don't really want to be. It's useful to have some idea of what the application is doing. You need to know what the sort of data is going into it, how it's going to be working, just so that you can, you know, you need to design the back end appropriately to handle what the application is doing. So I'm not going to go into the options right now. About it. But our system and the examples that I'm going to be using is two masters, not in circular replication, but we need two to avoid a single point of failure. There's every system administrator's nightmare. We've got three slaves, we've got a Linux virtual server and LDirectorZ set up on a high availability load balancer, which is actually a separate thing for the MySQL cluster. We're using DIBD 0.7 because that's what was stable at the time. 8.0 is the current stable release, and I encourage you to use that. Heartbeat release 2, which is far superior to Heartbeat release 1, don't even bother with release 1. MySQL 5.0, obviously there's later versions out now, but you can choose what you want to use with that. And a bunch of scripts, some of which I've written from scratch, some of which I've taken from the net and made some changes to. So in setting up the masters, try and use the identical hardware if you can. If you've got two different systems and you end up with performance problems, it's going to be a real nightmare trying to diagnose where the problems are. You want to allocate a good amount of space for how much the database needs now and what it'll use for as long down the track as you can plan for. This should be fairly rudimentary stuff with any system you should know. You want to start out by building DIBD for your kernel and operating system. There's a kernel module. The 8.13 they're working on to get it into a coding style that is more kernel friendly, and hopefully getting that into the mainline kernel. But for the moment, you've got to build that separately. There's instructions on the DIBD website. So you want to set up your config file after that's installed. And all of these config files and scripts, most of them are taken out all the comments because it's there's too big to fit on the large slide. I've got the presentation and all of the, or I will have at least written, all of the supporting scripts and configuration files up on the net. So don't worry about writing stuff down. You can download that one. So we're going to define a resource, which is basically akin to a sort of, and for those who don't know DIBD, it's basically like RAID 1 for network. You have a disk that you want to replicate onto another one, and those block devices are kept completely distinct. So we've got a resource, which I call MySQL Master. Most of these settings are fairly standard, apart from maybe the net setting, which you want to calculate to in particular deployment using bandwidth display calculations. Sinker, which will vary depending on the nature of the network. Most of those are fairly straightforward. Now this is the interesting bit. We've got our two masters. which I've creatively named Shark and Octopus. And we're setting up which device node we actually want the DIBD device to appear at. The physical disk, which I've put on LVM on each machine, which we're using for the master file system. The address of that node, which I'll need to communicate with the two, between the two masters, and where the metadisk data is, which can be on a separate physical device or it can be internal. I've gone internal in this situation. Now, buffers and caching, cache data and buffering is kind of the natural enemy to data integrity. If you've got a situation where you're buffering or caching data and it's not protected, power goes out, which can be for any number of reasons, then you block that data. If you're just running a community website, it might not be that important, but if you've got, you know, really high importance data, you don't want to lose anything, you don't want to be at risk of losing anything at all. And this applies to every single part of your system. So we use DIBD protocol C, and that basically will only return from the write of the current primary once it has been committed to physical disk on the other end. So you can absolutely guarantee that when something returns from a write operation on the current master, that data is safe on the other node. It can't exist in any other state. And you can see what the other protocols there do, which are better for long links or whatever, but really you can't guarantee your data integrity. You want to turn off your disk, write back caching. Unfortunately, it's turned on by default and loose disk by these states. That's a big problem. You can use battery backed write caching, and if that's on a RAID controller, you probably get associated benefits with that. There's this funny feature called write barriers, which I only discovered in the last few weeks. It's very hard to find out about them, but they're not supported by Prusa or DLD in this situation anyway. So we start DIBD on both nodes. We start at syncing, and this is 0.7 version. Command do what I say kind of implies, you know, force or some other similar parameter that I use above command, but that's not really true. They've fixed that up in 8.0 to get more straightforward. So we're setting, and this is on just one of the nodes. It will, they'll both connect. One of them will become the primary, and that will be the where the other one will start getting started from initially, which will be blank to start with anyway. And then you can check proc DIBD, which is proc to be that until they both become in sync, and only then really start using the DIBD and you start using that on the primary. And at that point you might want to, you know, create your files and all that sort of stuff. So Heartbeat, which is the second part of this system, which is a very, very, very cool piece of software, essentially just sends little heartbeats, obviously, between the nodes to make sure they're alive or dead, and makes decisions based on the state of the various nodes. There are other constraints that you can put in, and it's extremely flexible. As I said before, release 2 is much better than release 1. It's much more flexible. Unfortunately, a lot harder to understand in terms of the resource file, but in the long run, better for you, I'm sure. You've got three main configuration files, the first two of which are pretty much identical to release one. Again, scripted comments, very interesting, but essentially it's the main configuration file. It determines how frequently we send out heartbeats, how long before we consider another node dead, how long before we want to warn in the log file of, you know, if there are like delayed heartbeats coming back. We've got an initial dead period, which is useful for when you know, a node starts up and you want to give it a bit of breathing time before it actually starts everything up from the fresh boot. A configuration line for where we actually send the heartbeats out and receive them back, and you can use multiple instances of that, and I encourage you to. It's very wise to set up several links, several physical links on which you want to send out your heartbeats. There's nothing worse than having someone accidentally pull out a network cable and only one that you had sending out heartbeats, and then suddenly the cluster goes into free fall, and everything decides to become, everything decides to become the master nightmare when it all comes back and discovers that there's like multiple masters around. List of the nodes, i.e. the heartbeat nodes. CRM yes is the only way that you can actually get the release two functionality. If you don't have that line in there, then it will operate in heartbeat one mode and a couple of other things, auto join, so you don't get other nodes trying to join automatically, which might suit the situation, but I don't use it. Yep. And the other thrilling configuration file, which is a bit of authentication between the nodes in your heartbeat cluster. This is the main configuration file, yes, it's in XML, and yes, you have to get to love it eventually. That's what you've got to work with. So there's a whole lot of other stuff at the top, which I've stripped out, most of which is default. Again, this is all on the XML, including in the entirety. So we've got a resources section, and we've got a number of resources that we want to manage on these masters. We've got an IP address, so that we're not bound to specifying which IP address of these particular machines we use in the master when we're communicating with it. Sort of a floating IP address that we can always send stuff to. We know that's going to be the master, which physical machine is serving it. We've got a control for the DIBD. DIBD is always started on the master. They're always in communication as long as everything's okay. The only thing we need to control is which one is the primary and which one is the secondary. And by default, they're both the secondary, unless heartbeat tells us it's the primary. That's what controls it. And then we've got the file system that we mount on top of that. I've just used an EXT3 file system. And once the DIBD is started, then we can mount the file system, obviously. And then just an LSB script to start the MySQL master instance. Now, these are defined in order. When a master is picked, it will start them in the order that I've defined them. It doesn't necessarily need to be that way. You can specify, I can't remember what the parameter is, but you can specify in numeric order explicitly to start them up. If you don't do that, it'll just start them in the order you've defined. And then finally, just a little mail to thing, which isn't necessary, but that's, it'll send you an email saying that it started the resource. MySQL master configuration file, most of that's very standard. Only a couple of things I need to draw your attention to are sync bin log equals one, which also touches on that write buffering and caching issue. If you don't have that on and a transaction was committed to the master but wasn't completely written to the bin log, and you get a failover at that point, all of your slaves will go, hey, I want to retry connecting to the master at such and such position, say 20,000 position, when the other one, the machine that's taking over as the master, might not actually have that data on the disk, which will break your replication. You've got to fix it manually. Nobody wants to do that. You want everything to be as automatic as possible, and storing the temp directory on the VRBD disk as well. Slave configuration, again, fairly standard. If you've got the binary logging on, you want to probably run 16.1 on that. And at line 17, you can find read-only. Just to make sure no external data gets into the slave aside from what we've replicated. This means we don't have to worry about the data changing unexpectedly. So Linux virtual server, this is something that we use on the slave. Not literally loaded on the slaves, but it's what we use when we've got a bunch of slaves. The application doesn't want to know that we've got five slave servers to connect to one of these and have to worry about that. So we use this to load balance, and LVS is built into the kernel. It's very fast. You might know of MySQL proxy, which can also supposedly do load balancing, but as far as I know, it doesn't do it nearly as smartly as LBS does. It's a use-based program and operates on queries. It's not going to be anywhere near as fast, and certainly isn't flexible without writing a whole bunch of evaluate scripts. So LVS, we tell it that we've got a virtual slave, if you like. That takes all of the connections from the application, read queries, that is, and then distributes it to the real slave servers behind the scenes. The tools that come with that, like IPVS, they're good, but they're not that easy to automate, really, so we use LDirectLD, which is kind of like a, you give it a config file and it takes care of all of the low-level command, putting servers in and out of the LVS resource. And here's an LDirectLD configuration fragment. We've got a bunch of globals up the top, defining how frequently we want to check the slaves to make sure they're still available. Auto reload equals yes, which means we can add or remove slaves permanently into the config file, and it will reload that file every now and then. And then quiescent equals no, which is a bit of a strange option, which you can probably just read about online. So we've got the virtual server, which is what the application connects to, like I said. A scheduler, which is just like an algorithm for how we'll actually distribute the queries or the TCP connections more accurately. The real servers and awaiting that we give to them. MASC is a particular type of way that we'll communicate, allow the traffic to come through the load and it back. There's a number of ways you can do that depending on your network design. And then we also include in there, as a last resort, the master. If all of the slaves have problems with replication, we don't want the entire application to come to a standstill because we can't issue any read queries. So we have the master in there at a very low weighting. There's no way that I know of to have it as a complete standby, so it's only ever used if everything else is unavailable. This system with the 65535 waiting for the other ones and one for the master actually means the master will get one query for every, whatever that is, 190,000 queries to the other servers. There's just no way around that nicely, even if you set quiescent to yes, which is useful for sorts of problems. So getting data onto the slaves, if you've got a clean slate, there's no data in the master database, it's easy to set up a replication and then start adding data and all this magically appear everywhere. There's no real nice way without doing a hell of a lot of blocking and dumping or copying files and things to set up a new slave and to say, just grab all of the master data from wherever it starts, like you do with slowing down the stress. So unfortunately, that's just something you have to work around. I've got a Perl script that basically fills, you know, lots of tables and dumps. And that script is very long and lots of people here, but this is how you call it basically. What it does is it stops the local slave, it connects to the source, which can be the master or another slave if you've already got one. You don't want to lock the master any more than you want than you need to. If you can take a copy of the data off another slave that's already been set up, then by all means do that. Does flush tables with relock, reads the binary log file name and position, and even if you've got, even if you're taking a copy of the data off a slave, you can read another couple of variables that indicate where the slave's data refers to the master's binary log. So you can use those numbers when you're starting to use slaves, starting replication to use slaves. Use the MySQL dump to pipe the data from the source onto the slave. Unlocks the tables and starts the replication using the binary log file name position and dot support. And like I said, once you've got one slave, you can set up all the other ones as well in another slave. So that's probably a very confusing and very rapidly notated way to set up the actual replication, but you're not done by a long shot. There's so many resources out there that you can find through Google that tell you how to set up replication, which is great because it means, you know, the knowledge is getting out there. But you know, they show you how to set up the replication, they do a few insert queries. Oh my god, the data's now on the slave, it's amazing, you've set up your replication, now go out there and, you know, be fruitful and multiply it. That's just not realistic at all? I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of people who just set up the replication and believe it. It's working all the time. It's not going to work all the time. You're not providing service capability to being monitored. Reuse Nagios, Nagios, or however you want to pronounce it, and NRPE to monitor a bunch of things on the master and the slaves. We use check proc for heartbeat processes just to make sure that's running. You could spend an awful lot of time trying to monitor heartbeat. There's all sorts of ways you could do it. We use check DRBD for DRBD, funnily enough, and I think that was a script that I found on the net, and the website was no longer exists, and I've just tweaked that a little bit to make sure they're both connected and they're in sync. There's this thing called DOPD for automatic monitoring and response to DRBD problems, but it seems like you could get into a lot of trouble where you might actually outdate both copies of the DRBD data if something goes horribly wrong. So I choose not to use that. And you do need to know if there's a problem anyway, so why have something doing automatic response if you have to look into the problem yourself anyway, if the automatic process can possibly prove something fun. There's a bunch of things that you want to monitor with your replication. I think we're running a bit short. So basically, I've got a number of levels of replication paranoia. You want to check that the threads are running, the replication threads are running, the seconds behind master is acceptable, even though it's a bit of a sort of fake indication of where the replication is at. You can do a thing like inserting a timestamp on the master and then reading that back later on the slave and seeing how far behind it is in terms of actual real world seconds. You can do things like check some database or table, and then you've got level 3, which is really specific to your application, check on the data. So seeing if there's a number of orders in the orders table, seeing if that differs on the master and the slave. You can spend a lot of time on that. That's a small 12 fragment for writing heartbeats on the master. Again, there's a lot of depth, so this will be pretty soon. Let's see. This is another little bit of a thing. Oh, we're loud again. A little thing that I put in which kind of makes use of the monitoring we already had through Nagios. This thing called that I call LVS Helper, and it checks the state of the replication in the same way that Nagios does. And then based on that, if the slave is what we determine to be out of date, it's not good to be sending queries to it still. You don't want a whole bunch of slaves to be in there in dubious replication states and still for them to be returning answers to queries. So what this does is, if the replication check returns critical, it will actually insert a firewall rule to block it off the load balancer. And that will basically, the next time LDirectLD does a check on this server, it will not be able to connect, and we use a reject, not a drop, just to make sure it returns as fast as we can. And that will automatically drop the slave out of the load balance group. Now, when it gets back into sync, whether we do that manually or it comes back of its own accord, LVS Helper will check again. If it is okay, and we've got that rule in there, it will take it out. LDirectLD will do another check, and it will be returned automatically into the load balance group. So that's a really nice feature to have. I don't think we've got too much time for backups, but you can come on to the other talk and you'd like to get a chance to go into that. There's a whole lot of links there. First one is where I'm putting the, that's my company's sort of knowledge site. You can get the entire talk from there and all of the links, all of the scripts will be up there pretty soon. Has anybody got any questions? Yep. Yeah, the question was, we've got the slaves configured as read-only. Does that mean the application is aware that they've got to do read slaves right to the master? Yes. This is one of the important things that you've got to do with the application. You've got to let the developers know that they're going to have separate read and write targets. Another possible way you can do it is with MySQL proxy, but I'm not sure if it's entirely mature in this aspect yet. You can actually do sort of read and write separation. But that, as far as I know, that's sort of based on like regular expression checking of the actual queries, see if it's a select or an insert or an update. And yeah, I'm not sure if it's quite there yet. But at the moment, yeah, you've got to have separate read and write targets. All right.